Hey, this is Photography in Society, their podcast by the Master Programme under the same name at the Royal Academy of the Art in The Hague.
What does it mean to do research as a visual maker?
In what ways can research be conducted?
How can making things guide thinking processes and vice versa? These are some of the guiding questions behind Unstill, the season of our podcast focusing on the research processes and works of the graduates of 2023.
Grandfather, peatlands, war, trauma, intergenerational trauma, ecology, memory, climate change, deep time. My name is Daniel Chatard, pronouns he, him. Originally like a photojournalist and documentary photographer from Germany. So before I came here to MAPS, I studied photojournalism and documentary photography in Hanover in Germany. And I have been working since as a photographer, mostly for magazines or newspapers, but also on my own projects. I work mostly with photography. I've been doing some video as well, like a short movie. For my graduation project, I'm including some archival materials, but yeah, photography is really at the core, I would say. Themes that are reoccurring in my work, I would say, are definitely like landscape photography in relation to ecology and the climate crisis, but also topics like social inequality. So I'm kind of trying to understand through the space that I'm looking at how these topics kind of come down in that area that I'm looking at. So usually I'm like investigating or like going to a specific place over and over again and build a project there. My current work, like my master's project, is about, or it started from the memories of my grandfather, who never really talked about his memories from the wartime. So my German grandfather was a political prisoner of the Nazis during the Second World War. He was in a camp called Bergamoor, which is in the northwest of Germany, for like some months. And it's actually one of the earliest concentration camps and then turned into a prison camp. And since he was a political prisoner and kind of against the Nazis, trying to fight against them, what I was always wondering about is why he never talked about these experiences, because you would expect that, okay, if you stand on the wrong side of history, like if you believed in the Nazis or were part of them, then of course you don't want to brag about that. But if you're actually trying to fight against them, why would you never talk about that and be silent about that? So that was a bit the starting point. I just started researching about this place, about Bergamoor, and I found out that none of the structure of the camp still exists today, and like there's not really much. There's only a memorial stone, and I was kind of disappointed when I first read that, so there's nothing much I could go and see there. Then at some point I decided to do so anyways. And it was partly also because the prisoners of the camp were forced to work in the surrounding peatlands. So this whole region, the Emsland, was mostly consisting of peatlands. So peatlands are these kind of, it's a swampy area where you cannot really walk. You never really know if you sink in or not. And the prisoners had to work there, draining peatlands with manual labor, making ditches, like so that the water goes off, and to turn this land into fertile soil that you can grow things on. Throughout this project, I also started to figure out new ways that I could see photography as research, also how to incorporate research in my work itself. It was the first time that I went to archives, for example, like just also for the nature of the project, because like a lot of things I'm looking at happened in the past. Speaking with a lot of people there that have expertise on the topic is a way that I like to work, so like just having conversations. To me, photography goes along in this process of research with other things that I'm doing. So I can't really separate one from another, because I'm there talking with somebody, taking their photos. We're looking at photos together through that process, because I'm interacting with people or I'm interacting with a landscape. I can also generate new knowledge. And so it is part of, or it is my research, actually. before my grandfather died, he wrote down his memoirs. So after his death, so when I was like 18 or so, we received this unfinished booklet of his memoirs, which is like 60 pages long. So that's actually like quite a lot of his thoughts and experience during that time, which is like really great source, and I'm very happy to have it. At the same time, it's kind of, it's still a bit distant in a way that like he talks about his political thoughts there and how he analyzed what probably happened and stuff like that, but not so much about his feelings. And some parts that I believe must have been like really traumatic for him, he doesn't really write much about. But then again, like he describes two images, actually. He talks in images then that like he cannot forget, which for me as a photographer, of course, was kind of interesting because otherwise he never talks about photography or images. I don't think that he was particularly interested in that. But when talking about traumatic events, he has these images that were kind of stuck into his head. After the war, he became a journalist. So, I mean, he was used to writing things down, writing articles, writing about politics. And I think the way he wrote his memoirs was also a bit in that style. So it was just his manner of bringing things to paper. I'm not sure who his memoirs were addressed to, but I guess he wrote it also because my mother asked him several times. But I'm still thinking that he might have had in the back of his head that it might get published also, or something else might happen. I think it was first just to have an account of his memories for his family, but potentially also for another audience, I think. I started this project already a bit more than a year ago. So in the beginning, I made this short movie where I did reenactments of memories that either he was writing about or other members of my family had. And I don't think that these memories like necessarily represent exactly how things have been, but I was rather interested how it evolved over time or how the imagination plays into that as well. So based on that, I reenacted some scenes where it's quite dark and there's like a light moving through the scene and you just see two persons falling for it. So one memory that he describes was he was drafted to the Wehrmacht and he was in Eastern Europe, and he sees like two SS soldiers who execute old Russian couple for no apparent reason. They ask the soldiers above them why they did this, and they were like, well, maybe it was partisans. Then he answers, well, I doubt it because they are so old, it's the countryside and whatever. And then they're like, well, then maybe it was Jews. So this is one experience where he kind of like throughout the time understood more and more to what extent the system is inhuman. So this form of reenacting these themes was my initial response to that topic. But then I kind of moved away from that. And for a while I was kind of unsure, how do I want to deal with that then? And this is only when like this place, Bergamoor and the Emsland, kind of comes in, where I decided to go there and carry out my project there. My grandfather writes very little about this camp in Bergamoor, so it's just a very small paragraph. But something he writes is that there in this kind of shadow world, like another world that the people in the rest of society cannot see, he learned things about the system that would never stand in the newspaper and that other people were not able to understand, therefore. So in the Emsland, there were like 15 camps in total, called the Emsland camps. So I kind of focused on that whole region and the history of these camps. So I went to an archive where they had documentation on that. And there I understood that there's one official memorial site in the region, and they erected that in 2011. And I was like, wow, 2011? Really? That's quite recent. Like, so there were, for more than 60 years, there was no official memorial site whatsoever. In the region, there was a long resistance also after the war against the processing of that trauma and of these crimes. And still in 1980, there was a local government said that if these camps existed, then it was only criminals who were incarcerated there, which, yeah, actually it's not true, because there were political prisoners, but there were also homosexuals, there were prisoners of war. So it was quite a mix of people who were there. And in the end, 30,000 people died in these camps. They pushed that away for a really long time. Similarly with my grandfather, who kind of pushed away that history and like tried to forget it, the society also didn't want to be confronted with this. And then I was thinking, because peat is actually quite a interesting soil, you can see in the peat there are some roots and some branches, and those are hundreds or probably rather thousands of years old. And so I got interested in the peat itself, because everything that falls into the peat is kind of conserved there for hundreds or thousands of years. And I read this article by a scientist who wrote that peatlands are less land than a memory of what has existed on it. And that notion was really striking for me, because there was not much I could hold on to when looking at this story from my grandfather, because yeah, he didn't talk much about it. And in the society, this topic was also a long time, like nobody wanted to talk about it. But then I kind of started to see the peatlands itself as a repository of that history. Peat itself is kind of the one thing that was there the whole time and that still has the memory on it. But then after a while, I kind of learned how, to what extent this landscape was actually altered after the war, and in what a bad condition the peatland actually is today, in a way that then the peat also again reflects how the society pushed away all these memories, or my grandfather pushed away all these memories, and like even like the peat is so altered by humans that I'm kind of wondering if I can still see it, or to what extent it still has the history of the place in it. All the peatlands in the world, they cover 3% of the Earth's surface, which is not so much, but they store twice as much carbon as all the forests. They're actually super important for the climate. They can act as a carbon sink, like they can suck carbon out of the atmosphere, but they can also release all the carbon that is stored inside them if they're drained, which they are in northern Germany. So almost all of the peatlands have been drained there, so they are slowly emitting CO2. Is basically, you can imagine it like a forest burning really slowly. And you don't see it because they're turned into farmland, for example. So there are farmers growing food on them, or there are cows grazing on them. But what happens is that the soil, as long as it's not wet, is mineralizing and it's releasing CO2 into the atmosphere. And in Germany, that makes up 7% of the greenhouse gas emissions. So that's quite a lot. And I talked with a geologist who said that the plans of the German government to change or like to act upon peatlands to save emissions until 2045, he thinks maybe half of it can be done. Because all these processes take up so much time that this is a time frame that politicians are not used to work within. This soil is built up for thousands of years. If you destroy it, you can't just change that in some years. So it needs a lot of time to restore them. I was kind of interested in the peat as a material itself, and I read that in 1 meter of peatlands, there's kind of 1,000 years of the history, because it grows, like every year it grows 1 millimeter. So it's like really very, very slow process. I kind of wanted to mimic that, or like go into that direction of deep time also with the photographic process itself. So to extend the exposure time from the fraction of a second to like several days or weeks. So one thing that I've been kind of extensively doing is a technique called pinhole photography. So it's actually like one of the oldest photographic techniques. It's very down to earth. So you don't really have a lens. I used old beer cans, aluminum cans, and just put a photo paper inside it, sealed it, and then made a tiny hole with a needle. And then I mounted these cans onto the landscape. I just looked for trees or poles standing in the landscape where I could attach the pinhole cameras to. And then I left them there for several weeks, like mostly around 4 weeks. And like throughout that time, that would be the exposure of the photo. And the photographs itself then are a bit more abstract, I would say. So they're like black and white, and sometimes there's weird effects that I also can't really control, patches of light, like where it's like really white and I don't really know why. And of course, the image is also not super sharp, but you can still see the landscape in it. And I think that this gap of also like not seeing everything like leaves space for your imagination. I'm also using some of the archival images that I found. So For example, images from the photo album of the camp guard. I met the son of a camp guard who was exactly at the camp where my grandfather was. I was just curious about him because his father made a photo album also about his own life and his work at the camp and everything. So it's a really weird mix between personal photos with his girlfriend and him standing with his new car in front of the fence of the camp and like the prisoners working in the peat and stuff like that. So to me, it was quite a unique view into the history there because, yeah, there was not much left. And there I could see from the personal perspective of the oppressor what that looked like. And it was interesting to talk about that with the son who still had like, he didn't see his father guilty really of any crimes or so. He was like, well, he had to find a job and he kind of had to do this. And also, well, he was part of the NSDAP, but if he was in the SA or SS, we don't really know. Yeah, that's something unclear. I also can't prove it otherwise, and I don't have to prove anything to him. And he's also 80 years old, so I didn't want to make him like give him like a bad conscience. He also had a lot of trouble growing up with this father. And I think that's for the second generation after the war, that's something very present. So also my mother and her siblings, for them, this whole history is still closer to their personal lives because they grew up with this like very traumatized parents or at least fathers. So for them, it's still kind of painful. And I realized that for my generation, it's a bit different, at least for me personally, because I have more of a distance to what happened. I'm still kind of affected by it, but I'm mostly just curious why people didn't talk about that for such a long time. And I think I, through this whole project, slowly started to find these answers to that. I'm also using some of the archival images from the archive on the Emsland camps, and also images from the Peatland Museum, because the cultivation of the peat itself, the prisoners of the camps had to work in the peatlands, but that was manual labor. And after the war, the politicians said, oh, we need to develop this region. It's like, it's very poor economically, like really underdeveloped, and we need to do something. So they brought in like huge machines and with them like drained the peatlands and also started like harvesting the peat more. So, and today peat is used as a crucial ingredient in garden soil, for example. So it's still being farmed. So that changed the landscape really drastically. And in the 50s, the German Ministry for the Marshall Plan. So the Marshall Plan was an economic plan implemented from the US and Germany to like boost German economy after the war. And the Ministry for the Marshall Plan made this movie about the Emsland Plan, which is called Bog Dawn, where they kind of promote the... They say, okay, we bring in the big machines and now prosperity will grow here. We turn all of this into settlements and farmland and stuff like that. So I'm using images also from that movie. I also took, what you would call a traditional photograph. So I just had my digital camera and took photographs of the landscape as it is now. I think at the beginning it was just normal way of working, let's say. Also because in the end, this project is also rooted in the present. I'm walking around this place that I don't know in the beginning and like just trying slowly to understand how the past has affected it, mixing these layers with the world that we live in now. To me, the whole outcome as it is now is a bit unexpected. So like, especially with the pinhole photographs at the beginning, I had no idea how it will turn out. It was just kind of an experiment. And I would say I experimented a lot throughout this process. Most of the stuff that I did for the first time. Visiting archives, looking at a history that is so long ago, but also still affecting the present. Yeah, these different techniques. Also the way I want to display the works now, I've never done before. I bought this cabinet, which has like many drawers. And on the drawers, I want to put these different materials that I gathered together. You see these many layers, basically. And that's, to me, kind of mimicking the layers of history in the ground. I'm thinking now that I will probably also mix these different aspects that I'm talking about in the visuals. To me, they're all connected. I think for me, the main challenge that I came across was that so many aspects of the story that I want to say are not visible today anymore. I come from a more traditional side in photography. Usually I just go somewhere and photograph what happens, but there's like nothing much happens. So I needed to find a different way to tell these stories, basically. And that took a lot of time. What was also difficult was to combine all these aspects of the story that are to me important and that I see connected into something that people are actually able to understand. And I think in some presentations with the tutors or so, they were like, what is he talking about? It's like, you tell me this story and then this story, but which one do you want to tell? It's too much. But I think now I can slowly manage to bring it across so that they're really becoming one. It was a long process to kind of connect all of this. I think I would definitely continue with this project after graduation. So, I mean, now I'm working mostly for exhibition presentation, but I think I would be interested to make a book out of it as well, and also maybe find a like first more local form of involvement, for example, through a residency, and then finding people that would be interested to collaborate in to some extent. So I'm thinking to bring this video part back in and work with people from there who would be interested to try and make something. But yeah, I have to see, I have to make plans. Well, I think looking at these histories, especially with the war, it's pretty obvious that there's so much damage that was done in the past that's still obviously affected the people who were directly involved in this, but also the people who came after. And I think it's not too late for people from my generation to slowly look into this and try to process that trauma. Before us, no one has done it. So it's, yeah, we can pushing it away, or we say, okay, intergenerational trauma is a thing. And I've had actually many people from my generation come to me, told me their own stories about their grandparents and how it affected them. Still a thing that's quite present in German society, and even not just in Germany. It's up to us to decide if we want to deal with this package that we've been handed over in terms of the trauma. But also, if you look at the peat, there is something that needs to be done. Like, we need to relate back to that landscape and see how it affects our lives and see how we can better, yeah, live with it, or like bring it to a state that's like closer to ecological balance, at least try to stop it from emitting CO2. So I think these are tasks that have been handed over to us in a way, and finding ways to connect to that and deal with it. That's basically what I want to communicate with the project also.
Thank you for listening to Unstill, a season of Photography and Society, the podcast by the master program under the same name at the Royal Academy of the Art, The Hague.
If you are curious to hear more about the research processes of the graduating students of 2023, listen to the remaining episodes from this season.
This season was designed and produced by Sophie Allerding
and Emilia Martini.